Hello and welcome to the Gender Swap podcast. I am Judith.
And I'm Lena. And today is our first English episode and our first interview episode ever. And for our first guest, we have none other than the co-founder and mastermind behind the One Shot Network. We have James D'Amato on the show, everybody. I'm very excited. Hi, James. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, heroes. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hello, James. Thanks for coming.
I'm very honored to be here for so many firsts. I am sorry that you have to speak in English on my account. I will also apologize to the listeners for that.
No problem.
It's fine.
Many listeners in Germany are able to understand English podcasts. That's okay.
They just have to suffer a German accent.
Yeah.
So in the last interactions with our Twitter people, we came to know that not everyone knows the One Shot Network here in Germany. So would you be so kind of maybe just do a little introduction and tell us about your network and your work?
Absolutely. So the One Shot Network is a company that's based in Chicago, and we produce entertainment content surrounding tabletop games. Some of that is actual play, recorded instances of people playing tabletop RPGs, and the rest is discussion. So that can be interview programs, that can be programs that sort of talk about the industry, like our shows Session Zero, which examines role-playing from a psychological perspective. We have two psychologists who examine what psychological effects role-playing games might have on people and how we can understand these games better through the lens of psychology.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, or Asians Represent, which is all about Asian contributions to role-playing games, celebrating folks who are Asian and working in the industry now, folks from the past who we might have missed, and sort of examining Asian representation in RPGs throughout history in where it succeeded and more likely failed, and how we can do better moving forward. So that's that. But our flagship shows are One Shot and Campaign. One Shot is a show that I host where about every month we produce a new actual play in a new role-playing system. And we release those as weekly hour-long episodes. So in our five-year history, we have featured well over 100 games on our program, just sampling them, giving listeners an idea of what it's like to play in a different role-playing system. Most of the players that I work with are either comedians or game designers. So most of our episodes are very funny, but we also do have, you know, a handful of series where we try to go for a more emotional, dramatic presentation.
Yeah, you made me cry like a lot.
We do our best. We've got some tearjerker episodes coming up that I am very much looking forward to. But Campaign sort of examines like the other end of role-playing rather than doing these sort of like bite-sized looks at different role-playing systems. It is long-form gaming. So we'll play one story for multiple years. Our first was a Star Wars game that was GM'd by our network's co-founder, who is sadly no longer with the network, Kat Kuhl, and that was in the Star Wars Edge of the Empire system. And our newest arc is called Skyjacks, and it is about sky pirates, and it's GM'd by myself. But our network overall, our core ethos, our goals are to make tabletop role-playing games more approachable to people and to make the community surrounding those games more inclusive.
Great. That's just our gem. where do you see the network in the RPG community in the US? What would you say?
It's interesting. I would consider us to be like a large mid-sized network. From people who started and their primary claim to fame was just producing podcasts, we're one of the larger networks. The networks that have more resources or what have you than us are networks that are helmed by people who are bringing in some fame or cachet from other things. Like, for instance, I don't think you could possibly compare our network and its reach to the McElroy brothers who produced The Adventure Zone, but they also are famous from doing other podcasts. And there's Critical Role, which is helmed by Matt Mercer, who is a very famous voice actor. So objectively, if you look at RPG podcasting as a whole in the United States and really internationally, I think One Shot is a very big network. It's just we're several steps below in terms of reach and resources from the biggest names in the business. And, you know, that's just because the only thing I've ever really done that has won any notoriety is this. I'm not carrying in a lot of other reasons to like interact with me. You pretty much have to be really into RPGs to want to listen to any of our shows.
That's right. Well, you basically run a podcast network for your living, so what's that like?
It's wild.
It's wild.
It's the sort of thing where, like, if 5-6 years ago, before we started this network, if you had come to me and said, hey, this is going to be your full-time job soon, I would have not even believed, like, in the concept of actual play, right? you know, like, you'd have to explain to me, like, yeah, you essentially play games for a living. I would have doubted the efficacy of people even wanting to listen to role-playing games, let alone the ability of podcasting to support me professionally. At that time, I was like trying to be a comedian, so I definitely wanted to do some form of entertainment, but this is so far outside the traditional path to a career in comedy that I would have trouble wrapping my head around it.
I can't imagine.
Sometimes even working the job, I have trouble wrapping my head around it. It's interesting. It is very different in terms of responsibility and scope than I would imagine from the outside. Things that end up taking my time really surprise me.
Yeah, you sometimes tweet about like you want to do editing, but you need to do a lot of paperwork and read contracts.
Yeah, a surprising amount of my work from April through now has been drafting contracts. I have to figure out how to create agreements for our performers, for the hosts on our network, for the freelancers that we hire to create art and other supplementary materials for our shows. And like, somebody has to do that. And as the, you know, now sole owner of the network, a lot of that responsibility falls on me. So while I do get to say that I play games for a living, because the actual plays that we record are most definitely the thing that drives our income as a network, there's also just a lot of paperwork and general boring business stuff that I would not have thought, you know, describing this career path.
I became a freelancer last year, and I was freelancing before, but I had a day job, and it takes a lot of time. I could not imagine that to do stuff that you are not going to be paid for, but you need it to be paid for other things you do. So yep. All the contract stuff and social media and all that.
It's very interesting. I will say the things that I love to do probably take up like the least amount of my time.
Because
editing a show, like to produce an hour-long episode, editing can take anywhere from 2 to 6 hours, depending on how challenging the audio file that I'm starting out with is. Like, I'm usually a 2-to-4 person, which I know based on conversations that I've had with other people who do similar work, that is very fast. But, you know, you think of the ratio of game that I have played to work that I do to produce the entertainment content, vastly most of my time is spent in editing.
How do you pick the games you record on the show? I mean, I have a follow-up question to this one because you just decided to do something very different this year.
Mm-hmm.
But how did you generally pick the games you feature on the show?
So generally speaking, I am always kind of scouting out for new stuff for us to feature. So there are a lot of different paths that things will find me. You know, like one super obvious one is that I've played the game before in my gaming past, and I know that I enjoy it and I just want to share it. The amount of games that exist like that, I think, are fewer and fewer because we featured most of them. The other ways would be I now have lots of conversations with friends who are in the industry, and they're all bringing their own favorites and experiences to the table when they talk to me. So Alex Roberts spoke very highly of Kagamatsu before we decided to make it our feature for this month. And, you know, she had been going on about it for years, and I knew that it was something that I wanted to get on the show. There are designers who will approach me either either through email or in person at conventions who will talk about their games. But I'm also browsing. I'm on Twitter constantly looking for announcements of new games. There are a couple forums that I frequent looking for new games. And of course, I spend quite a bit of time on Kickstarter just browsing the tabletop game section for projects that appeal to me. And a lot of it is me just identifying like, ooh, this would be good at some point. Unless there is a Kickstarter that I know is coming up, most of the time when I find a game that I know I'm going to feature, it's in my back pocket until I come across the right moment to run it. I want to make sure that I have a really good cast of people that is going to do well for the game, or that a particular game is going to play to the skills of the cast that I have put together for it. Like Dogs in the Vineyard was a game that we featured probably, I think that was 2016 or 2017. But Dogs in the Vineyard is a very sort of dramatic Western game that was designed by Vince Baker. It's a very cool system. It's kind of dated now, but a lot of the innovations that came out of that system have precipitated to other games in the industry. Like it's this real cornerstone piece of early 2000s design. And Vince Baker wrote it about his personal relationship with Mormonism on top of Western themes and whatnot that was tangled together in it. And I have two friends who happen to be in the Mormon church. And I wanted, like, if we were going to explore the game, because there is kind of this angle on it, and that's kind of a complex thing, I want to be sensitive both to the artist who first created the game, because they were trying to say something with that piece of design. I couldn't put together a group like JPC, James Dugan and Alex Manich, who were from our Three Rocketeers episodes and Inspectors episodes, because they wouldn't have risen to meet the tone of the game. They wouldn't have addressed what Vincent was trying to say through that game. And I also wanted to be sensitive to people who happen to be of that faith who might be in my audience, because Vince Baker described it as his breakup letter to the Mormon church.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a very interesting kind of emotional journey, like especially reading it knowing that. So these two players, there were two players who like I knew could do dramatic stuff because they're both actors and like I had seen them perform before and I had also played games with them. So I knew that they would be excellent in these roles for so many reasons. And Dogs in the Vineyard is something that I had wanted to feature on our show for years and years, but it finally came to a moment where I had the perfect cast. I had the perfect game for that cast. And I think the series that we did for it was really fun and good. So yeah, I find games from a lot of different sources, some active, some passive, and they get on the show usually once I have constructed the perfect cast to pair with the game.
Well, in the last episode, the first in 2019, you announced that this year you will only feature games that are written by marginalized authors. I would like to talk about this a bit more because it's a great idea. I love that you're doing this. And it's like Judith said, it's a gem, the whole more inclusive, more diverse RPG world. Could you tell a little bit how he came up with that idea?
Absolutely. You know, one thing that I try to do as someone in this community is look to marginalized voices, whether they are people who are already established in the industry or people who are trying to break in, to sort of periodic temperature checks of how are we doing as stewards of our community? Is this hobby actually approachable? If I were a marginalized person who wanted to get into tabletop RPGs and I tried to take my first steps, how easy would that be for me? Are there things that would prevent my being able to indulge in this hobby? Are there things that would scare me away or make me think that, oh, this space is not going to be a safe and nurturing environment for me? And marginalized folks, especially those who have established themselves in the industry, will say the thing that people need to do because they see a lot, and like, I don't want to be speaking too much. This is just me sort of paraphrasing a bunch of different tweet threads that I've read and whatnot. They've said that, like, if you are somebody who has social capital in this community, you have to be taking active steps in order to make it an inclusive space.
Yes.
And, you know, I've definitely learned as a cis white man in the game space, I don't know necessarily what environments are comfortable and uncomfortable for people who are not like me. I would be the worst judge of that sort of thing. So you kind of have to take your cue from other people, and you have to actually work to make a difference. You can't sit back and go, okay, I would accept somebody from a marginalized identity at my gaming table. I would be happy with it. And I know most of my friends would be happy to have more people involved in the community. So that's my due diligence. I'm done. That doesn't work.
If a marginalized person rolls up at my game table,
we won't say no. He just has to come.
Yeah.
The thing is, there are a lot of people, when you suggest that gaming is not an inclusive space, the first thought that they have is, well, I'm an inclusive person.
Yes, exactly. There's still some kind of gatekeeping going on, whether it's only because the community is so homogenous and white and, yes, cis male somehow still, so that I can imagine it was hard for us, I think, to go to our first cons as women.
Yeah.
But we are white women. We have no trouble being around our friends. And I can imagine if you are not an able-bodied person, if you're not white, the look of this community is some kind of gatekeeping in itself.
Yeah, exactly. Like a lot of people, when they think about, okay, well, what is keeping folks from marginalized groups from really embracing RPGs as a hobby? The first thing they think of is active gatekeeping. You know, negative yes. people in the space who are warding people away. But that's only a fraction of the overall thing that's going on. And this plays into a lot of the decision that we made. Because I was listening to these conversations, because I was hearing people say this, I decided to look at One Shot and see, if from a critical lens, how are we doing and what more could we be doing? And the thing that I found is that if you look at the One Shot archive, up until now, we have definitely tried to feature the work of people who are from marginalized groups, whether that has to do with race, whether that has to do with sexual orientation, whether that has to do with gender or ability. There's a vast sort of diversity that we tried to get, but at the end of the day, about 80% of the games that we have featured on our shows have had lead designers, people who are in primary roles and benefit the most from the publication of that game, have been games that were helmed by cis white men. And the thing is, I wasn't trying to make it so that cis white men were the primary represented group. In fact, if you had asked me, what did I want? Ideally, I would have said, oh, I want diversity. But 80% leaning towards cis white men is not diversity.
But I guess probably about 80% of all games being published in general are by white men.
Yes, it just happens.
That could be a huge part of it. Like that's one element of it. So I wasn't trying to do this, but this thing happened. So it sort of makes you take stock of the fact that structurally, our industry as a whole is oriented to cater to cis white men. That's who's in the space. That's who's meant to be comfortable in the space. And I just told y'all like how I find my games. I find my games by looking at conversations on Twitter, by going to conventions, by browsing Kickstarter. And the fact is, cis white men have a clear privileged advantage in all of those categories. They're just more likely to get noticed, not even just because there are more of them and because there are more games designed by them. Those spaces are oriented to cater to their needs.
Yes, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. When there's a resource like me that can benefit games by providing them a platform to get discovered, by providing some marketing work, I am more likely to find them just because the space works better for them. So dealing with those facts, if we were to just simply continue to have our goodwill and be opening and accepting as a company the way we have been, our goal of making tabletops more inclusive wouldn't work. because the spaces themselves are structurally favoring a particular identity. So in order to combat that, in order to work against that and like work towards our ultimate goal, we have to take active steps. And my theory, my hope is that taking this year, first of all, it's going to amount to somewhere around 20 to 30 games featured total in a year. That's about what we do. It's about one or two a month. So it's not going to vastly change the demographic of our archive, but it is going to provide direct monetary benefit to the designers whom we feature, because games that appear on One Shot do tend to sell after they appear on One Shot. It's going to provide validation, encouragement, and notoriety for up-and-coming designers. And it's going to change people's perceptions of what a game designer looks like and what the game community looks like. Because I'm sure if you asked somebody cold, what is the primary demographic that makes up game design and game designers, people would probably tell you cis white male without even thinking about it. You know, I can tell you a lot of the designers that I know happen to be from a huge range of identities. And there are definitely cis white men in there, but I wouldn't say that they make up the vast majority of people driving these games anymore. So there's that perception that needs to be dealt with as well. Unfortunately, that does mean that in order to accomplish this task, the thing that I had to do is decide that, okay, that means for this year, for some amount of time, I need to actively say, no, we're not going to feature work of this certain demographic of designer. And it's not because it's not good work. It's not because it's not worthy work. And it's not because those people did anything wrong. It's because by no fault of many of the people who are involved in the tabletop hobby today, it is structured to cater to one particular demographic. So we've got to do something somewhere. And I hope that this is just a small part of a larger thing of other people making active choices to develop the hobby in particular ways.
I think it's going to happen. I noticed several approaches to that and several New Year's resolutions where people said, I will listen more to podcasts made by women or by POC, or I will read more books that are not written by a white male man. And not because they are bad, but because we need to change our perspective and have more than just one street into that whole fiction thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is just the thing that I have decided to do for One Shot. It's not a network-wide edict or anything like that. So of the two dozen shows that are on the network, one is going to be committed to this pledge. There were people who expressed frustration.
I just wanted to ask here.
Yeah. It expressed frustration that we were cutting out cis white men, or, you know, we were taking away platform from them or being exclusive in our quest for inclusivity. And it's simply not true. Like, if you really, really want to consume content that examines the work of cis white men, you can do that a lot of places on
Everywhere.
The One Shot Network. Yeah. And the fact is, a lot of those designers, they're going to have opportunities elsewhere. Making this decision means that this year, my good friend and partner on the network, Jim McClure, is going to be launching a game that he designed, and One Shot can't feature it. That doesn't mean he's not going to get promotion on the network and that his game is not going to get the opportunity to get viewed elsewhere. Those opportunities still exist. We're not excising people from the industry. We're just looking at a problem and taking steps to address that problem. Like, at the end of the day, I want the One Shot archive to reflect that we are a company that cares about making the industry more inclusive. And I can't do that if 80% of the games that we've featured are just from one demographic of people.
Yeah, I think it's very cool you're doing this. I hope it pays off in purchases for the games you feature and more representation of marginalized creators.
Yes, fingers crossed.
I'm hopeful not so much that there's going to be direct benefit, because again, at the end of the day, that's 20 games, that's 20 designers that we're going to be able to prop up and make sure that there's some benefit for. I am hoping that other people who are in my position in the industry can take a look at this and sort of examine what is my intent for the industry? What are my desires for the industry versus what am I actually doing to accomplish that? Because I know that I have been very active trying to promote inclusivity in the industry, but I still ended up in this position and I still needed to take this action. So I'm willing to bet that there are other people who are in my position or similar positions who can take more action as well, and that we can move forward. Because again, I want to be very realistic about what we're doing here. It's small. It's a very small thing that needs to be accompanied by a larger movement of things to have any real impact or meaning.
But I think it's good to get people thinking. When you put it out there that you won't feature any game made by a cis white man this year, then maybe it gets people into thinking, okay, how many of my games are by someone who's not a white man? It's always a bit problematic when you start counting and taking quotas or something like that, but I believe that's the only thing that will help, because most of the people are not aware how homogenous this whole community can look like from the outside.
And most players say, I don't care whether the creator is a woman or a man, whether they are heterosexual or homosexual, or whether they're black or white or POC. I just care about is the game good or not. And we have to change that, because it will change nothing to think that way. Because this place is built for one kind of person and they will prevail there if we go on to think like that.
Exactly. There are a lot of people who have convinced themselves that the games that are successful, the games that exist, are there for a reason, and that reason has to do specifically with quality, or games that they like, that is all made up because of some sort of objective truth that they have discovered. And in a lot of situations, when people think that way, it is just their privileges talking, and they're really not taking time to examine what it is that's going on.
I also think the gaming community will only be enriched by more diverse creators, because I think there's a special games or the way you would design a game that is just not the same for everybody. I mean, I don't think a man could have written Bluebeard's Bride.
Absolutely not. Yeah. When you look at art pieces like Bluebeard's Bride or Kagamatsu, the game that we are featuring on the show right now, they are both specifically about examining gender dynamics. Like, Kagamatsu calls for a female identified person or non-binary identified person to run the game.
Yeah, I ran it twice last year.
Oh, and we made an episode about it.
Oh, cool. Okay, cool. So your audience is already familiar. That's great.
I ran it once for my gaming group, which worked out fine because I'm the only girl. So, and it was an experience, I gotta say. It was so weird jamming it. When you're playing Kagematsu and all your male fellow gamers just look at you and try to play a shy woman and look up at you. It's so strange.
It really is. It's kind of a magical experience in a way. And because of that game is one of the foundational design texts that Alex Roberts used to create StarCrossed. The idea of having a lead and a follow partially precipitated from relationship dynamics in Kagamatsu.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And those are two really out of the park, amazing, innovative games that I really doubt a traditional designer would have come up with, you know, the person that people are picturing as dominating the industry. We just can't have great design like that unless we invite new people into the space and get new perspectives. Role-playing games are driven by empathy and putting yourself outside of your own identity and role. And you can't do that if there's just one type of person who is dictating how things in that space operate. You're going to keep getting the same experiences over and over again.
As we just dived into that political thing, I have another question for you. You sometimes do political calls for action since the Trump election, and we are under the impression that there's also some negative feedback regarding it.
Yes, it's mostly come in Patreon exit surveys that I see, and one or two emails, I mean, not one or two, there are a handful of emails that we have received as time has worn on of people voicing their displeasure with that. For those that don't listen to One Shot, which is the show that we do it, at the end of our episodes, we put in a political call to action where I say to my audience, hey, do this thing, you know, make sure you are registered to vote or call your representatives about an issue that you care about. It's something political. Like, we don't endorse a particular political party. We don't endorse political candidates or anything like that. But what we do is encourage our audience to stay engaged in a political sense in their everyday lives. Because before the 2016 election went down, I was certain that Hillary Clinton was going to win. I had this strong belief in my fellow citizens and in my country that we were going to select the clearly qualified person to run the country, because there are a lot of people in our country who have negative views. And I just felt that that negativity wasn't the predominant view, or it wasn't so powerful that it was going to be able to dictate who would get the chief executive office in our country. And that turned out not to be true. It is kind of fine to step back from politics if you think that your involvement isn't necessary. Like, during the Obama years, my views largely were represented. Like, there are a couple things that I disagree with President Obama about, but...
But in retrospective, it's all small things.
There are a couple things, but like, for the most part, I felt like the country was trending in the right direction, and that even the conservative leaders that we were looking at that were vying for office, they weren't George Bush. I thought in George W. Bush, the country had learned an important lesson about, I don't know, about social progress and about the negative impact all of these policies had on people. And it turned out that that perception was wrong, and that through my inaction, possibly, I had led to the complacency that built up this climate where this terrible person was able to be elected. So I looked at my life and like, okay, well, what did you do to prevent this? And now that we are living in this situation, it is your responsibility, because at the end of the day, I'm a cis white man. I am queer. I am bisexual. But like, I am not going to suffer the most for this terrible thing that happened. And it is just the correct thing to do everything that I can to mitigate the harm that is being done and to see that this doesn't continue to happen, to stop this. So, you know, the reach of our podcast, like, we have a fairly large audience, but it's not enormous. But I figured using the reach of that podcast in some way was kind of a moral imperative for me. It was, you have to do everything you can to prevent this, because this is real evil that you're up against here.
And you're right, you can do it from a relatively secure point where you're standing compared to other people.
Yeah, there are people who are angry at me. There are people who took funding away from me, who stopped supporting me financially for this. But I'm still here. I'm still working. This is my primary vocation, which means that I could afford to do this, clearly, because I'm here still doing it. And it's not going to change the world, but I am hoping that encouraging my audience to stay engaged will help us get out of this bad situation.
We all hope so.
Yeah, I'm always really furious at my German neighbors and stuff who always say, well, the Americans, they're guilty for voting for Trump and it's their own responsibility. And I think there are so many people like you who are really not content and not happy with it and fighting against it. And it's really important that we know here as well that you do all that's possible for you to engage politically.
It's so interesting talking to folks from Europe, because I cannot blame people being dismissive or frustrated with America, because political decisions that happen here do impact the rest of the world, because the horrible imperialists, the tendencies that were built into our deep political DNA, we have put ourselves in that position. So I identify with that frustration and that perspective. But I can also tell you, we know that the majority of Americans did not want this to happen.
No, if you look at the exact votes, you can clearly see that the majority did not want that. What really confuses me is the whole election system. This is so screwed up. The whole, you have to prove you are allowed to vote and you have to jump through so many hoops to just get your voice counted.
Well, and that's by intention too. I don't want to dive too deep into politics, but like that is the Republican Party very specifically creating barriers to prevent certain demographics from being able to show up to the polls and have their voices heard. Like they are trying to manipulate the system to change results, which is frustrating as somebody who doesn't want these bad things to happen. And as somebody who has a lot of friends who are suffering and family that is suffering directly because of these political decisions made. On the one hand, I do really empathize with that frustration from folks in Europe who have to deal with dumb things that happen in this country. But also, there is very real suffering going on here and a very real frustration going on here. And we're working to fix things. But right now, people in power are against us on that. And it's going to take a lot of work.
Well, we have our own fair share of problems with the far right and populism. And it's not like it's perfect.
It's hubris to say that this can only happen in the US. It's happening here right now, and it's happening in France and in Poland and everywhere around us that the right wing is strengthening. And yeah, we have to fight it everywhere.
Cheery!
Okay, cheery. Let's get back to gaming, shall we? That actually reminds me of another point. It's not really a question, more of a thought. That when you take action and speak about, hey, let's make gaming more diverse and inclusive, there are some people who always say, oh, I don't want you to put all these politics into my hobby. Mm. Which is like such a bullshit thing to say, because there's already politics involved when you just protect the status quo.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you for bringing that up.
It's a thing Judith and I are rambling about for years now.
Yes, we're on the same page.
That is the main comment that I would get on an exit survey or an angry email. They are upset because they see some benefit to trying to keep an entertainment space like mine, like divorced from politics. They think that they're entitled to that and that it somehow affects the value of what we're doing if we excise politics from the process. And, you know, the thing is, I am a strong proponent of the belief that games are art and that all art is political in some way.
Yes.
And that the games,
totally,
the games that people think are apolitical are actually very political. It's just the primary ideology that has sunk into the DNA of that game so much that you don't even think to question it. Like Dungeons and Dragons is a very imperialistic game. It is a game designed by a culture that was sort of steeped in imperialism and from, you know, the United States. So a culture of people who settled land that was not theirs. It's all in that game. It's built into its DNA because the primary thing that you do in Dungeons and Dragons is kill things that are weaker than you and take their resources. That's political. It's not good politics.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's political.
And it supports all that mindset we already have, because we are still in that still not decolonized mindset. And so we can fulfill this role very easily. Go out and, as you say, slay the weak and take their belongings. They are the evil weaks.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's the thing. It identifies anything that does not operate the way your culture operates as evil. Like that is built into the mechanics of the early editions of that game. That's just how it's supposed to be.
And also, we did some research about romance and RPG, because we did two episodes on romance and sex and relations. And there was one article that talked about the Numenera Dove and Sex in the Ninth World, Glimmer. And the article was stating that in most fantasy or sci-fi setting, there's only explanation for a society that is different than the usual patriarchal heteronormative society. So it's just explained why it is different. It is never questioned why it is the way we know from our real world.
Yeah, I mean, if you started writing down the ways that our real world culture would operate, I think by the end of it, you would end up with something that appears very satirical, because there are some buck wild things that we just accept as normal.
Yeah. Like, hey, you got to sleep with a guy when you go on 3 dates.
Yep. But no. Or it says something about you. And boy, if you do it before then, that also says something about you.
Oh, yeah. One more thought, one more question about gaming. Do you think your way you look at games, or you look at people you gamed with before you were trying to make gaming more inclusive, has changed? Like when you play D&D, or when you imagine you go back to playing D&D with some old college buddies or high school buddies, I don't know, would you still enjoy it?
You know, I think I would be able to enjoy experiences that I had before. Like, I mean, take Shadowrun, for example. That is a game that my relationship with it has transformed so much through my experiences at One Shot. Shadowrun is the first game that I played after playing Dungeons and Dragons. And to me, it was like a revelatory design that challenged so much of what I thought the RPG experience had to be, and opened the world and made it so much wider and bigger for me and what was possible in games. And now, today, after playing all the games that I have played, I know that Shadowrun is probably just a half step over from D&D. Also, I kind of thought, ooh, this is kind of a neat progressive political thing. Like, it's being satirical, it's discussing issues like race and class and whatnot. And today also, I can fully appreciate that the ways that it does a lot of that stuff is kind of tone deaf. So definitely my perception has changed, but I am still able to enjoy it. If I were to sit down and play a game of Shadowrun today, even if I was to play with the people that I played with in college, I think there would be ways that I could enjoy it. But I definitely, my experience of play and what decisions I do in terms of I make in terms of play has changed a lot. And I would question things that I did in the past a lot. Like, there are definitely things that I think about and groan about what I've done in the past, just because, like, I've grown as a person and I've learned new things and I've incorporated those lessons into my basic worldview. I think people have some element of that no matter what. Like, if you think of the type of person you were in college or high school, you will roll your eyes. Yeah.
There is this ancient creature in Star Wars Rebels who says, once a secret is known, it cannot be unknown.
And yeah,
that's the same with those things you learn about your surroundings and about communities and culture. And you cannot unlearn them, and you cannot have a holiday from it, I think. It's always with you.
Exactly. And it is a blessing for sure, because it gives you the better opportunities to do the right thing and correct problems. And it's a curse, because you live with the guilt and shame of things that you are not proud of. But I still think, like, yes, there are fun things about this experience. There are things that I can enjoy about this experience. Like, Daniel Kwan, one of the contributors on our network, is a historian, and he is an Asian man, Asian Canadian man. So he is very aware of the position of folks in marginalized cultures. He's very aware of the negative impact of imperialism on the world and on himself, really. But he also runs this wonderful after-school program where people play role-playing games, children play role-playing games and learn from them. And he still enjoys D&D. Like, he is playing a D&D game with his partner, and they are enjoying that process. So I think there are ways to recognize problematic elements of things and still engage with the art and still enjoy the art. The thing that you have to be aware of is, in the process of doing that you are not putting more active harm into the world. And if you can sort of separate that, I think it is still possible to enjoy things that have problematic elements to them.
And you can incorporate new things into stuff that has problematic elements, I think. You can change
exactly.
it a bit. It's not chiseled in stone.
Yeah, on his episode of Backstory, Daniel and Alex discussed the prospect of making anti-colonial vision of D&D, of like, you know, what does that game become if you take colonialist elements out of it? Are you going to learn things about other cultures and appreciate things about other cultures? How do we intersperse these anti-colonial ideas with action and elements that we find fun in gameplay? And you know, it turns out, even from the few minutes that they indulged that thought exercise, that there is something there. There's something palpably fun there. So you can take the fun of that experience, question, okay, like what's fun about Dungeons and Dragons? What do I enjoy about this thing? And how do I challenge problematic ideas in it to make it more suited to my tastes now that I have a greater awareness?
You wrote a book.
I did.
And we discussed this book in our personal play episode.
Yes.
A term which I believe you also kind of invented.
I will say, since we're talking about personal play and its origin, I believe I'm the first person who said that term, but I have discovered in between writing that book and now that there were people who referred to that as lonely fun and as also Barbie play.
Yeah, Barbie play is a term we came across as well.
Yeah, we wondered if this is a German term, because we really found very few articles or information about this. And the only thing we found was on a German website. So we thought it was maybe invented by Germans.
It very well could be. The larger thing that this told me is whether or not the idea of personal play is an idea that it was unique when I had it, because it most certainly wasn't. People were talking about it by other names. It's definitely a thing that people don't talk about that often.
No, we got a ton of reactions to that episode. So, hey, I do that too.
People really opened up. That was great.
I love the term personal play because I think Barbie play is a little bit like
derisive.
The one article we found about that was talking about, okay, someone who does Barbie play is someone who only thinks about the fluff pieces of his character and not doing the important work of optimizing the crunchy stuff.
Yeah, I don't like the way that term sort of creates a hierarchy. It feels very dismissive yeah. of the activity of personal play and also of Barbies. And the value yeah. of role-playing with dolls and action figures, which is the first role-playing experience that a lot of people had in their lives and not something that we should look down on.
Very true. So the thing about your book, which is called The Ultimate RPG Character Backstory Guide, just to put it out there one more time. When I read it, it felt very D&D centered. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a fact that you know, but in Germany, D&D is not such a big deal as in the US. And I think neither of us has ever played a game of D&D in her life.
Wow. That's
yeah.
We have our own kind of D&D-like setting here in Germany.
So a lot of the ideas in the character backstory guide might translate to that.
Yeah, totally. It was just funny in a way that it clearly uses some certain D&D terms that are just not familiar when you never played D&D.
Oh, wow.
Totally okay, because even if you never have played D&D, you probably know most of the terms.
D&D is such a huge cultural impact, so although we never played D&D, we know a lot of stuff about it.
I was just wondering if there was a goal to design it especially for D&D players, or if D&D is just so implemented in the US gaming experience that that's always the starting point.
The reason that I decided to orient it not so much towards D&D, there is a lot of specific D&D stuff in there, but you know, when you think of it, it's 100 exercises in the book, and maybe about 10 of them are explicitly referring to D&D in certain ways. The predominant thing that's in the book is that fantasy, like medieval fantasy roleplay, is the primary setting that it envisions. And that is because in the United States and English-speaking spaces for role-playing games, it is impossible to excise D&D's influence over it. It is the first defined the medium. It defined its imitators and innovators that went after it. Changed everything about how games operated because it invented the role-playing game as we think of role-playing games. And when people think of role-playing games, to a certain extent, they think of D&D, and that shapes a lot of the assumptions that they make about how a role-playing game has to operate. One of the very early design hurdles that a lot of new designers have to get over is taking away the assumptions that D&D gives you from your design sensibility and learning how to design in a space where D&D isn't the only thing that exists. And for an international scene, even if Dungeons & Dragons is not the only game that is played or the most popular game that is played, it probably played an important role in the origin of role-playing games being a thing in that space, which I don't know the specific history of this German game, but I would be willing to bet it is a D&D imitator.
Yeah, the history of that game was that a German company wanted to publish a role-playing game, but the license fee for D&D was
too much.
They sat some people down and say, hey, just please, could you design something just like that, but in German? So that's what they did. It was a huge games publisher, huge enough to force the shops who wanted to put out board games and stuff like puzzles to order some copies of that said game.
Yeah, I'd love to give you some puzzles, but I've got all these D&D books sitting in the way.
Yeah.
It even had TV commercials, I think, back in 1983 or something like
that. Wow.
Yes.
Oh, that's extremely cool. That mirrors kind of the experience of taking D&D to Japan too. Dungeons & Dragons sort of made a small appearance on the Japanese scene. Like, there was a translation that was made of it. And I think even a small print run that was officially branded D&D, Japanese players got their hands on this thing. And then the most popular and influential role-playing games that sprung out after were just people doing their own version of D&D. You can even see this in terms of the video game design, like the idea of the JRPG, your Final Fantasies, your Dragon Quests. All of that precipitates from D&D coming to Japan. And D&D today is not the most popular game in Japan, but the most popular game in Japan has a lot of roots tied up in D&D.
Yeah, totally. At this point, there are a lot of people playing D&D in Germany as well. But the book, we really like the book when we discussed it a bit, but I was wondering, did you already use it yourself? For example, for creating the new campaign characters?
Sort of, actually, yeah. We recorded our character creation sessions for campaign, and we can't release those because there are so many spoilers for stuff right now, so that we'll release them at some point once more information is out there. But we did use the Taming of the Wolverine exercise somewhat for Johnny's character because he had kind of envisioned himself as a charismatic loner thief. And it's like, okay, that can totally work as a role, but we need to create reasons that you're invested in your group and you're going to cooperate with your group.
That's a great exercise. I didn't do it, but I read it and it's totally convincing. Everyone should do this when a character like that comes up.
But we also have done a couple of specific instances of taking exercises from the book and just doing them. Like, we did it with the character creation cast. We did a stream with Amelia and my good friend Steve Desconte, just doing a couple exercises in the book when we were doing promotion. And I think Damn Merlennials was the one that we did. That's the one about a generation gap between two different generations of adventurers. And we had invented, like, it was a lot of cool world building and stuff for characters that I enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, I love that there's also world building in there. Yeah, there's this one thing where you talk about how is the magic school supplied and what's the biggest army and what kind of army is it?
And yeah, your holiday at home. That was
The holiday is
your favorite holiday. And how do you, what do you do? And who's going to help you in your group to celebrate it when you're not at home?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of fun ones that I have enjoyed playing as games. I think one of the fun things as a game designer and author is the moment that you discover that you can actually play your work, you can remove yourself from your design brain and sit down and just enjoy an experience.
Yes, that's great. Do you have a favorite exercise for yourself or for your characters?
Ooh, boy. It's kind of hard to pick exercises specifically that are my favorites. I really do like Campfire quite a bit. it's one that I haven't got a chance to play myself.
That one's really cool.
Yeah, I want to play it because it is kind of an homage to the way that Kat and I would play when we were in college. Our Dungeon Master was very much a by-the-book Dungeon Master. We were playing 3.5, and pretty much no matter what was going on, if we were traveling and, you know, moving through a wilderness or something, we would have the chance of a random encounter during the night. So we needed to have characters stay on watches. And we sort of got into the habit of when two characters were on a watch, there would be a period of time where they would just talk in character and roleplay with each other in between their spot checks. And that's how Kat and I developed our taste for the narrative side of role-playing. And so I tried to create an exercise that kind of mimicked my experience of that, that would encourage players to invest in the other characters at the table, become interested in that, and develop backstories as a side effect of learning more about the other people at the table, to build that in-game intimacy, because these are still characters revealing secrets of their past. And, you know, build that up as like kind of a beautiful, quiet scene that happens in the middle of the chaos of the rest of a game. So you could play that outside of the game, or you could just bring it to the table and incorporate it as a mini game that you play during your regular role-playing sessions.
That's a great idea. I might incorporate it into my Blades in the Dark session.
Ooh, that would be so much fun to see.
We're always in some small places hiding and have lookouts, and I think it's the right thing to do, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see that.
We have one more question about the actual recording.
Oh, go for it.
In our last episode, we talked, among other things, about safety tools in gaming. And I was wondering if you use them in the recordings, and which one do you use? And if someone makes use of them to cut out a certain scene or topic, would you leave that in the recording, or would you rather edit it out?
So for safety tools, generally, like in campaign, because that's the thing where we first incorporated safety tools, on the Star Wars campaign, there was a point where Kat introduced the X card mechanic to the table. And one of the flaws with the male comedian brain, like in working with improvisers, is a difficulty to be vulnerable and expressing that vulnerability through humor. So I don't think that group embraced the safety mechanic or understood the value of the safety mechanic super well. We still use the X card at the table, and like I try to explain it every time when we record campaign. But most of the time with that group, because of the way improvisers are, a lot of it, I just have to be conscientious and aware of people's emotions at the table and look out for them and be super willing to stop what we're doing and go, hey, is this all right? Would we prefer to see a different thing here? And, you know, we've also been playing together so long that improv especially sort of builds up the ability to read your partner and trust your partner. So in that space, communication is more difficult and easier in some ways. But because of that, safety tools don't work as well there. On one shot, we definitely use safety tools. I usually introduce them to games where I think there is a big potential for people to be challenged. We recorded a couple months ago a session of The Watch, which is a Powered by the Apocalypse role-playing game.
Ah, the game we want to play so badly.
Yes.
It rules. I'm very, very, very excited about it. We did use the X card for that episode because there's just a lot of challenging emotional content in The Watch. Our Watch episodes are going to be airing in around March because we're going to make them our 300th episode.
Oh, great.
We recorded that with the Broadswords, and it is going to be very, very good. I'm super proud of how that turned out. But returning to safety mechanics, I also use safety mechanics anytime it is just built into the game. Anytime a safety mechanic has been used on a one-shot program, we have left it in. We've left it in because we see using safety mechanics and using them visibly as another thing that promotes inclusivity in the hobby, because it makes role-playing spaces safer if people understand how safety mechanics work and opt into using them, are willing to use them, become more familiar with them, it gets easier for people who have the potential to be triggered by challenging content or content that most people wouldn't think of as challenging. Like, it makes it easier to navigate that space. It creates a larger potential to avoid harm. Now, safety mechanics aren't perfect. And it's like, even though we have seat belts and airbags in our cars, you can't drive like a reckless maniac because you can still get hurt. But a game that uses safety mechanics is better and safer than a game that does not use safety mechanics, in my opinion. And I try to use them where I think they're going to be most effective and appropriate and featured in a way that will promote their use in other areas.
That's a great analogy with the car. I feel it's important to normalize the use of safety tools.
Absolutely.
We played a Edge of the Empire game in November and put the X card on the table and my players were, okay, we probably won't need it. And I said, no, we probably won't, but it's just, it has to be normal that the X card is on the mm-hmm. table. So I'm putting it there, even though we're playing a funny Star Wars game tonight.
I liked playing Starcrossed with Alex because in the episodes that we did for the podcast, she used the X card.
In the setting build-up, I remember that one, but I was not sure if there were others you edited out.
No, I like if it happens, it stays in there because it's part of the game.
It's part of the game, and it's I think it's so funny that there are two X cards, so everyone has it on their side of the table and doesn't have to reach. Mm-hmm. So it's not dangerous. Point at the X card, and the tower won't fall if you do. Really elegant.
Yes, I love the way that Alex has implemented it and the way she uses it too, because it's different than how I think I first pictured the X card when the concept was introduced to me. Like, what I thought was the X card is there as an emergency tool to use when you are entering territory where you feel uncomfortable. And the way Alex uses it when she is running that game is she uses it to proactively express comfort about certain things. And it might not be an emergency situation. It might just be a matter of taste. In our game, because I was playing an alien, I had sort of suggested the idea that my alien species had a Star Trek-esque view that, oh, you're not supposed to interact with planets that haven't developed technologically or culturally to a certain point. And Alex X-carded that and went, that's a really colonialist thing that Star Trek does, and I don't love that, and I don't want that to be a part of this game. So using the X-card that way, like, you still respect it the way you respect the X-card, and like, you think about, okay, she's not comfortable with incorporating that type of world building into this game, that gives me a good idea of the type of experience that you might want to have and what to avoid and how to make this more comfortable and fun. So it's not even just, oh my God, I've been triggered. I need to stop this harm now. It's, you know, I don't like that because it's related to more complicated issues that I don't like. So we'll use this X guard to say, hey, we don't want this content to be in the game.
That's advanced use of the X card. Great.
It's interesting. I've also seen pushback against that too. There was a designer of color on Twitter who was saying, hey, I don't like the way the X card is used sometimes because privileged players use it to avoid engaging with material that they don't understand or find challenging when it's not necessarily presenting a threat to them. Their example was somebody X-carding a situation where they were dealing with police being more critical of a character of color in the game. And a white player at the table X-carded that situation. And it's like, well, you know, you are not the person that experiences that type of discrimination. The person running the game is that person. So you using the X-card to prevent that person from expressing their experience isn't wonderful. So it's a double-edged sword there. I think Alex, when she used the X card in our game, I think that greatly improved our play experience. And I like it because it makes it more likely for groups, if they're going to use the X card, to use it because I think it is more common that you will encounter an experience like that than one where somebody feels like they are in real emotional danger. It's the sort of thing in training children to use emergency numbers these days, people recommend to have them actually press buttons on a mock phone, because when you get in a real emergency situation, you freeze up. And even though intellectually you know what to do, you have to dial emergency services, you don't actually follow through with that because you're not familiar with performing that action. To make the X card more viable as a solution and all safety mechanics more viable as a solution, you actually have to use them and be familiar with their use. So like, I really like that, but I also am super leery of the idea of people opting out of experiences where they could actually learn something because they're uncomfortable with their privilege being challenged in some way.
Great. That's actually the first example I heard of how an X-card could actually be harmful or just not great.
Huh. It's complicated.
That's fascinating. Yeah, it's really complicated.
Like all areas in life.
Yeah. And I think in the third episode of Asians Represent, they talked about safety tools. And Agatha said something like, it also takes courage to take the X card.
Absolutely.
It might take less courage than saying, hey guys, I'm not comfortable, but it's still just that the X card is there does not mean everybody will have the courage to use it, I'm afraid.
Yeah, there's a real vulnerability to it. Vulnerability is a thing that drives games, but it's also a thing that can make them, I don't want to say dangerous, but can present the potential for harm. When you make yourself vulnerable, you allow yourself on a level to be hurt. And if people aren't sensitive to you, if they don't take your feelings seriously enough, then harm can happen. So there are some people who might hide the vulnerability that they have and endure a situation that they're uncomfortable with because it's too difficult to actually speak up about it, which is why normalizing safety tools is important.
It will help if you see that others can open up or that others have the courage and you can take an example.
Yeah, there's a lot going on with it. You know, the thing is, ultimately, I am so grateful that we are living in an era where safety tools are more common and more people know how to use them. I think games in general are going to improve because of these safety tools proliferating through play experiences. But we're also very early on in it. So there's some growing pains. There's figuring out how these things work. They're establishing these norms so that we can innovate later on and benefit from this early discussion.
A lot is happening in the last years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and hopefully will be happening here as well. It's always like there's something going on in the US and 10 years later we get it here. So.
Well, hopefully shows like yours will help drive that forward
a little bit faster. It's just this whole discussion why gaming should be different. And I feel like it's a discussion you guys had some years ago.
We're just starting, yes.
Well, one of the cool things that we might experience out of this is the kind of interesting segmented parallel development we get when there is a language barrier between people creating something and people experiencing it. One of the coolest things, I think, about the role-playing scene in Japan is the only interaction they had with American role-playing games for a very long time was Dungeons & Dragons. And in the past 6 years, a couple Japanese designs have been trickling over to the United States. And the designers over there have been working outside the influence of design in our culture, and our culture has not been influenced by theirs so much. So the games that have made their way over are kind of amazing. They don't operate based on assumptions that our games do. So the idea that Germans are taking the X card or taking safety mechanics as a general concept and going to develop that in their culture to someday reveal a more refined version of to the United States really excites me quite a bit.
Maybe that's going to happen. We'll have to see. We have quite some translations and we have a lot of people who can speak English on a level that they can understand. But I think the stuff that is translated or is originally German is still played most because you don't have to speak kind of German-English mingled language at the table. or translate stuff yourself. So that's mostly easier to play games that are already translated or are originating here.
But it takes some time. I mean, the German version of Dungeon World was released last year.
Wild, wow.
So, and City of Mist is being translated right now. There is a German version of Genesis since 2018, but it's taking some time. Mm-hmm. So. And I feel there always is a little time between translating games that bring new ideas and creating your own games based on that ideas.
It's its own skill to like figure out how to translate. And a lot of the time, you know, it just might be easier to take what was cool or important about a design that you understand and make a unique thing. I think whether Germany as a role-playing scene gets a lot of translation from the United States or not is kind of immaterial in a way, because there are unique cultural assumptions that separate German players from American players. And I just think being part of the design conversation period is going to make things richer, because that cultural perspective is going to inform safety mechanics or any sort of mechanics in RPGs in ways that I, as somebody who just grew up in this American culture, really have no way of anticipating or understanding.
Yeah, I think safety mechanics are different in every culture, because they're just things that are totally normal in one culture and totally super weird in another.
One thing I just remembered is that Monster Hearts, it's not mm-hmm. yet translated, I think. When we play Monster Hearts, we have these images from high school movies from the US in our heads. But a friend of mine told me that you are supposed to relive your own high school experiences in that game. And so, to be fair, you would have to translate it into our school system, which is quite different.
Oh, wow. That is fascinating. I mean, yeah, a lot of that game is driven by the teenage experience. And that varying from culture to culture, I think, would impact how it's played quite a bit.
It would be quite different. I mean, in Germany, you're allowed to buy beer at age 16.
Yeah, wow. Holy cow. That changes everything. That changes everything.
High school movies from the US are often funny. I think so. Mm-hmm. The images we have in mind are somehow, I think, funnier than Monster Hearts is intended to be.
So it's interesting. Monster Hearts can be played in different ways. The approach that we had on One Shot was a very lighthearted approach. But even when I was reading those character sheets, I'm like, oh man, this game could be a deeply emotional experience. When I was in high school, one of the relationships that I was in was abusive. I was abused in my relationship, and the character that I played on Monster Hearts was the mortal. And the mortal's role in that game is kind of to be a supplicant person who endures abuse from this supernatural partner that they have. And the character that I played on the show was a ridiculous parody of a human being and very, very silly and lighthearted. But I could immediately see, like, if I had selected different moves, that character could have been a real emotional journey for me. I don't think Monster Hearts is meant to be played in a certain way, because it's a game that's meant to be played. You take the mechanics from that game and you do what you will with them. If you think that is having a lot of fun and doing silly bits, that's fine. And if you want to get into some real heady emotional territory, that is also fine.
Yes, it has a huge scope, I think.
Oh boy, you've really inspired my imagination. I would love to see a setting guidebook for a German school system for Monster Hearts. That would be so cool.
Yes, I guess.
I mean, it would be difficult writing work, because you would have to explain a lot of things that you feel like are obvious and don't need to be explained.
Yes.
I try to imagine what it would look like. And I just remember growing up in a small village, and I could not get anywhere on the weekend without my parents driving me there.
Same here.
Yeah, that could be pretty extensive. I'm a big fan of the System Mastery podcast. They reviewed a game from, I think, like a decade ago now, called Panty Explosion, which, despite its name, was a game that like most of the material in the book was just a very detailed description of how the Japanese school system works and what the experience is of your average Japanese girl going through that experience and like what social pressures exist and what hierarchies exist and things like that. So that was so dense and like it colored so much of their experience of what that game was. So there is a lot of potential for that book to get out of hand for you.
We already touched on this a bit earlier, that the RPG world is changing at the moment with the safety tools and the different perspectives. Do you think that the community and the RPG itself is indeed changing in the last years while you're doing the podcast?
Yes, I do think I have seen a pretty big change in the community, and I do think the community will continue to change. It's such a hard question to answer because I am also an American who lived through the 2016 elections, right? So one of the things that I've learned about my perception of culture and progress is that it's not always possible to trust it. And you can't bank on the idea that progress is going to be made. Progress is something that you actively have to pursue and work for. So I have the hope that people entering the RPG space now and people who enter the RPG space in the future are going to have a better, more inclusive environment than the one that I got into. And the best way that I can work to make sure that happens is by taking active steps at every opportunity I get.
Yes, thank you for answering that. Do you want to ask the last question, Lena?
Yeah, so this refers to a tweet where you spoke about making gaming a good place for everyone, and you ended up with the phrase, build kind spaces, which I think is really cool because what you said earlier, that gaming can be a place where you open up and can be very vulnerable. So I think there's a certain kindness required to do
absolutely
that. So the most of our listeners will not have a podcast network or be publishers or something. So do you have some advice how you can achieve these kind places in your own gaming group or at a convention? Any practical advice?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely want to mention that build kind spaces, and sometimes I say like build nurturing spaces or foster nurturing spaces, that is precipitated from my admiration for the designer Avery Alder, who worked on Monster Hearts, amongst many other wonderful games. She, for a year or so, maybe like a year and a half, stepped away from game design entirely to pursue a different career. And frankly, a lot of factors played into her decision to not be in the gaming space anymore. And one of the things that she said when she came back on her interview on Backstory was, she said that like when she left, she felt like that position in the culture was not nurturing her. And coming back with Monster Hearts 2, part of the investigation was, is this space and being in this space going to be something that nurtures me? Am I going to get enjoyment out of it? Am I going to see success from it? Should I be spending my time here? And I think about Avery and all of the wonderful games that she has made and the influence that she has had on the community at large and like my own personal role-playing experiences, even though I've only met her once, her designs have changed my world in a lot of ways. And I think about the fact that we were one or two bad experiences away from her never interacting with this space again, from completely excising this incredibly talented and valuable voice. And what if that had happened earlier? So when I think about environments, the thing is, you're not just trying to be accepting. Accepting is very passive. Accepting is somebody brings you something and you accept it. You don't outright reject it. You have
good job.
You, exactly. You've done nothing. Congratulations. You've done absolutely nothing. You have to be nurturing. You have to care for something. So you have to make sure that the people that you share this space with will derive some kind of value from being here. And that's where kindness and nurturing come in. And that's the core philosophy that I have, is make sure that the people that you're sharing this space with are going to get something out of it, and that the negative aspects of being here don't override the positive aspects of being here. I talk a lot about vulnerability because as an improviser, it's been drilled into me like how valuable vulnerability is and the different ways it can be defined. And navigating an RPG space is all vulnerability. It is vulnerable to expose weaknesses, and a lot of people think of that first when they think of vulnerability, but it is also vulnerable to expose passions. When you say, I think this thing is cool or important, or this makes me happy, you kind of open yourself up in a way for other people to come along and dunk on that and yes. like disrespect that.
Totally.
Oh, that's the worst.
And also disrespect you, which sucks. And role-playing, subconsciously, we're doing that no matter what. Because when we play characters in role-playing games, we are creating protagonists. We are creating characters that are the stars of their own stories. So on a certain level, when you bring a character to the table, you are saying, I think the ideas that make up this character are cool and important. I would have fun occupying this space for hours at a time. Just doing that, just making a character, bringing it to the table and sharing it with other people is an act of profound vulnerability. So being sensitive to that is the root of an actionable way to make a kind space. Understand when people talk about role-playing games, because it is kind of a fringe hobby, they are talking about their passions. They are exposing a vulnerability to you. When people tell you stories about their character, you know, it's kind of a mimetic idea that that is the most horrible experience that you can endure. But when people do that, they are sharing a deeply, deeply personal experience of themselves. I'm also a person who greatly admires fan fiction as a hobby, right? I think reading somebody's fan fiction is more intimate than reading their diary, because I think people are more likely to lie in their diary, lie to themselves, to lie about fictional characters that they're super passionate about and what they want to see from those characters. And, you know, fan fiction crosses over so much with role-playing games in like its emotional function. So be aware of that vulnerability, because it's huge. It's huge. And if you accept those things that people give you, those intimacies that people have for you with kindness and respect, you will start building the space better. Everything beyond that is make sure you are taking steps. You know, you can ask yourself, am I going to be accepting? Am I going to handle this in a passive way where I expect progress and change to be brought to me? Or am I going to be an active participant? Am I going to be nurturing and actually work to make sure that this is a good place to be? Because the price that we could pay is Avery Alder, is brilliant people like her who will give you great experiences. And it's a shame if we cut ourselves off from that because we're being goofuses.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a great last statement for this interview.
Thank you so much. That was mind-blowing.
Yes, that was really great. I never thought about this. I talk about my character. Gosh. Now I'm wondering what I'm revealing about myself. but before we wrap this up, is there a current project you want to talk about? This episode will probably air the first days of February. So I guess a certain Kickstarter about a certain second season of An Invisible Sun show could still be running.
It ends on February 1st.
Well, guys, at least James thought the Kickstarter would be over by the time this episode airs. But as it turns out, and as I, present day Lena, who is editing this episode, can tell you, it is indeed still up and running until next Friday, the 8th of February. So if you want to check it out, you can do this by following the links in the show notes. If you don't know what I'm talking about, A Woman with Hollow Eyes is an actual play of The Invisible Sun System by Monty Cook. It is GM'd by Darcy Ross and it stars James D'Amato and other cool players in a tale of surreal magic, queer love stories, and exploration of the fascinating world of Invisible Sun. It also has a really cool way of interacting with the audience watching in the Twitch livestream. Despite the time difference preventing me from ever watching an episode live, I enjoy watching the stored episodes on YouTube very much. Season 1 of A Woman with Hollow Eyes is one of the coolest things I watched in 2018. So if you want to check check it out, you can head over to the One Shot YouTube channel, which I'll also link in the show notes. You can also search for A Woman with Hollow Eyes in your podcast app or an Apple podcast, because season 1 is also being released as a podcast. I'm really looking forward to season 2. It is already funded, but there are still some cool stretch goals I would really like to see. So I'd be very happy if you check it out. And to use a phrase James always does in his podcasts, with all that out of the way, let's get back to the show.
So projects that you can watch out for in February. February on the One Shot podcast is going to be romance themed. We'll be featuring The Good Society, which is a Jane Austen inspired role-playing game. And we're also going to be featuring Passiones de las Passiones.
Funny, I have sessions of these two games in the next few weeks and months.
What a wonderful coincidence. Yeah, I'm excited. That one, Passion, is a role-playing game based on telenovelas. So it's going to be good. I'm going to enjoy it quite a bit. So be sure to watch out for those in February. I always want people to check out what we're doing on campaign with Skyjacks. It is a really, I think, interesting universe. It's super fun to play in. I love the music. I love the performances all of my friends are putting in there. I think it's going to be great. In February, also, we'll be airing the second season of A Woman with Hollow Eyes, assuming our Kickstarter went well enough. So you can head over to twitch.tv/oneshotrpg and subscribe to our streams so that you can catch up on that.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
That was our 7th episode of Gender Swap Podcast and our first interview with James D'Amato, our first interview of all times. And if you liked it, you can tell us on our Twitter, which is called @GenderSwapPod. Or you can head over to our website, www.genderswapped-podcast.de.
Or you can drop us an email at feedback@genderswap-podcast.de. Thank you, James, for being here to be our first interview guest and talking to us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was an honor to be your first interview. And I again, deeply apologize that I had to be your first English language episode. But I appreciate the hospitality. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for coming.
And thanks for listening. We see you next month.
Have a good time.